Chapter 5. But then, totally unexpectedly and unforeseen, a third force appeared on the gigantic chessboard. A poor, not very clever chess player, having put in place a defensive line of pawns to ward off a threatening opponent, and by the way, the Germans in their basin-like helmets are not too dissimilar to pawns, will group his other major pieces around his king. But his opponent's wily queen suddenly makes a flanking move to reach the back rank and launches an attack on his pawns and knights from the rear, placing the now very alarmed king in check. The queen in turn is followed by a rook in a dashing move up the board. The knights fly up to join the attack in a series of cunning zigzags, and the poor player is done for. His helpless king is checkmated. This all happened very quickly, but not totally unexpectedly. The ensuing events were heralded by a number of signs. One day in May, when the city had woken up to greet the morning, glittering like a pearl in turquoise, and the sun had appeared over the horizon to shine down onto the Hetman's kingdom, when the city's inhabitants had already started to move about their business like ants, and the sleepy shopkeepers were beginning to open the clattering blinds in the shop windows, it was shaken by a terrible and ominous sound. Nobody had heard anything like it before. It was unlike either gunfire or thunder, but it was of such strength that many casement windows opened of their own accord, and every window shook. Then the sound was repeated, ripping through the whole of the upper city, crashing down in waves onto Podol, the lower city, then across the lovely blue Dnieper, and farther on towards the vast plains and Moscow. Citizens were woken up, and there was total confusion on the streets. It was followed instantly by people pouring down from Pyacheresk, the upper city, howling and yelling, their clothes torn and covered in blood. And then the sound was heard a third time, and with such force that the windows shattered in the houses in Pyacheresk, and the ground shook underfoot. Many people saw women running about in just their nightdresses and shouting wildly. People soon discovered that the sound had come from outside the city, from Bald Hill, right by the Dnieper, where there were vast warehouses containing shells and gunpowder. It was there that the explosion had taken place. For the next 5 days, the city lived in fear, expecting the influx of poisonous gases from Bald Hill. But the explosion ceased. There was no influx of gases. The people covered in blood disappeared, and all parts of the city reassumed their peaceful appearance, with the exception of one corner of Pyacheresk, where a small number of houses collapsed. It goes without saying that the German High Command conducted a thorough investigation of the incident, and it goes equally without saying that the citizens remained none the wiser concerning the cause of the explosion. There were various different opinions. The explosion was the work of French spies. No, it was Bolshevik spies. The upshot of it all was that people simply forgot about it. The second sign occurred in the summer, when the city was covered in an abundance of dusty greenery, when the thunder crashed and roared, and when the German lieutenants drank an ocean of soda water. And this second sign was genuinely monstrous. In broad daylight on Nikolaevskaya Street, just where the cabbies were waiting to ply their trade, none other than the commander-in-chief of the German army in the Ukraine, Field Marshal Eichhorn, was assassinated. Field Marshal Eichhorn, the untouchable and proud general, someone who wielded terrible power, second only to Kaiser Wilhelm himself. The assassin was a factory worker, and a socialist, of course. Within 24 hours of the death of their countryman, the Germans had hanged not only the assassin, but even the cabbie who had brought him to the scene of the crime. This, it is true, did nothing to bring the famous general back to life, but it nevertheless set clever people thinking remarkable thoughts about the event. One evening, sitting with a glass of tea and lemon by the open window, struggling for breath and undoing the buttons of his linen shirt, Vasilisa was talking to Alexei in a conspiratorial whisper.
Putting all these events together, I cannot but arrive at the conclusion that our lives have become very uncertain. It seems to me that there's something unstable beneath the Germans, said Vasilisa, waving his stubby fingers in the air. Think about it. Eichhorn. And where it all happened. Eh?
Vasilisa rolled his eyes fearfully. Alexei heard him out in gloomy silence and left the room, his cheek twitching. One more portent occurred on the very next morning, directly impacting on Vasilisa himself. Early, very early, when the first cheerful finger of sunlight appeared in the dark underground passageway leading from the yard into Vasilisa's apartment, Vasilisa looked at the ray of sun and saw a vision. She was incomparable in the bright glow of her 30 years, in the dazzle of the necklaces on her swan-like neck, in her slender bare legs and resilient, quivering breasts. The vision's teeth gleamed white, and her eyelids cast a lilac shadow onto her cheeks. 50 today, said the vision in Ukrainian in a hypnotic voice, pointing at the churn of milk.
What do you mean, Yevdocha? Whined Vasilisa. For goodness sake, the day before yesterday it was 40, yesterday it was 45, and today it's 50. It can't go on like this.
What can I do about it? Replied the vision. It's expensive. It's 100 at the market, it seems.
Her teeth flashed once again. For an instant, Vasilisa forgot about the 50. He forgot about the 100. He forgot about everything. And he had a deliciously cool and daring feeling in the pit of his stomach. Something that he always felt whenever the beautiful vision appeared before him in the ray of sunlight. Vasilisa always rose earlier than his wife. He forgot about everything, beginning for some reason to imagine a forest glade and the scent of pine leaves.
See here, Yevdocha, Vasilisa said, licking his lips and cocking a glance to see if his wife had appeared. You've become quite a loose woman since the revolution. But just take care, the Germans will teach you a thing or two.
Should I pat her on the shoulder or not?
Vasilisa wondered in torment, but could not bring himself to do it. A full stream of milk, the color of alabaster, poured foaming into the jug.
Let him try and teach us a lesson. We'll teach him a thing or two in return, the vision suddenly replied.
The gleaming churn rattled and crashed on the yolk as it rose up out of the passageway, array within array, and up into the sunlit yard.
My God, just look at her legs, groaned Vasilisa to himself.
At that moment, he heard his wife's voice. Turning to look, he found himself face to face with her.
Who was that you were talking to?
His wife asked, darting a glance upwards.
Yevdocha, Vasilisa answered imperturbably. And guess what? Milk's gone up to 50 today.
What? Shrieked Vanda Mikhailovna. That's a scandal. The cheek of it. The peasants have gone totally mad. Yevdocha! Yevdocha!
She shouted out of the window.
Yevdocha!
But the vision had disappeared and did not return. Vasilisa looked at his wife's ugly, bent posture, her yellow hair, bony elbows, and dry, unattractive legs, and life on this earth suddenly became so intolerable that he wanted to spit at the hem of Vanda's skirt. Restraining himself with a sigh, he went back inside, into the semi-darkness, not fully understanding himself what it was that was nagging him. Maybe it was Vanda. He suddenly pictured her, with her protruding collarbones looking like the shaft of a horse's harness. Or maybe it was something awkward connected with what the ravishing vision had said.
We'll teach him. How do you like that, eh?
He muttered to himself.
Damn those blasted peasant markets. No, really, what would you say to that? Once they stop fearing the Germans, then that's it. We're finished. We'll teach him, eh? But her teeth, her magnificent teeth.
For some reason, he suddenly pictured Yevdocha naked, like a witch on a mountain.
The cheek of it, teach him indeed. But her breasts.
And the thought was so disconcerting that Vasilisa suddenly felt ill, and he went off to douse himself with cold water. And so autumn crept up on them imperceptibly. The sumptuous golden summer was succeeded by a bright and dusty September, and it was in September that a real event, rather than just a sign, occurred. And at first glance, it was an event of total insignificance. This is what happened. One fine September evening, a document arrived at the city prison, signed by the appropriate Hetman authorities, and authorizing the release of the prisoner held in cell number 666, That was all. That was all. But oh my goodness, it was precisely and without any doubt this document that was to be the cause of such misery and disaster, so many alarums and excursions, so much bloodshed and conflagration, so many pogroms, so much despair and horror. The prisoner who had been released bore the simplest and most insignificant of names, Semyon Vasilievich Petlura. He himself, together with the city's newspapers during the period between December 1918 and February 1919, called himself Simon, adopting somewhat the French manner. Simon's past was buried in impenetrable gloom. Some said that he was a bookkeeper.
No, he was an accountant.
No, he wasn't. He was a student.
On the corner of Nikolaevskaya Street and the Krestchatik stood a large, fashionable tobacco shop. On a long sign above the shop hung an exceedingly fine representation of a Turk in a fez smoking a hookah. The Turk was depicted wearing a pair of soft yellow slippers with upturned toes. There were some who could be found who attested to the fact that they had recently seen Simon in this very same shop, elegantly serving behind the counter, selling tobacco goods that had been produced in Solomon Cohen's factory. But there were others who maintained that it was nothing of the sort, and that he was the official representative of the Union of Municipalities.
No, not the Union of Municipalities, but the Rural Assembly, replied a third group. A typical rural hussar.
Yet a fourth group of people, visitors from elsewhere, closed their eyes in concentration and muttered, Just hold on a moment, if you please. And they began to tell everyone how they'd seen him one evening in Moscow, walking along Malaya Bronaya Street. It must have been 11 years ago. He was carrying a guitar under his arm, wrapped in black calico. And they even added that the reason he was carrying a guitar was because he was going to a party of fellow nationals from the Ukraine. Yes, that's right. He was on his way to a lively party with a group of red-cheeked, fun-loving Ukrainian girl students, with plum brandy direct from the bountiful Ukraine, and songs, including the song about the marvelous Grisha. No, please, don't go. Then their account began to lose its way, with dates, places, and descriptions of his appearance becoming confused. Clean-shaven, you say? No, just a moment. He had a beard, I think. But hold on, he wasn't from Moscow, surely, was he? No, he was just a student there. He was nothing of the sort. Ivan Ivanovich knows him. He was a village schoolteacher in Tarashcha. Damn it, maybe it wasn't Bronia Street he'd been walking along. Moscow is a large city. Bronia is often foggy and dark, and there can be hoarfrost there. A guitar, a sunlit Turk, a hooker, the guitar twanging away. Foggy. Can't see much. Oh my God, it's so foggy. Like a nightmare. The guards, cadets, sing. Blood-stained shadows, ghosts flitting past, young girls with their plaits flying in the wind, prisons, gunshots, frost, and the cross of St. Vladimir shining at midnight. The guards, cadets sing as down the street they pound, the trumpets and drums and the cymbals resound. Cymbals crashing, bullets whistling like nightingales, men being beaten to death with ramrods, black horsemen on the march on their fiery steeds. The prophetic dream crashes up to Alexei Turbin's bed as he lies asleep, his face pale in the pink glow of the lamplight, a damp lock of hair plastered to his hot forehead. The whole house is asleep. From the library comes the sound of Karas snoring, and from Nikolka's room of Shervinsky's whistling breath. Dark. Night. On the floor by Alexei's bed, a copy of Dostoevsky's The Devils lies open, filling the room with the sound of mocking, desperate voices. Elena is quietly asleep. Well, here's what I think. There was no such person. This Simon never existed. None of it existed. Neither the Turk, nor the guitar in the lamplight on Bronaya Street, nor the rural assembly, not a sausage. It's all simply a myth, concocted in the Ukraine, in the fog of that terrible year 1918. And there was something else as well. Sheer, undiluted hatred. The Germans numbered 400,000 men, but around them were 160 times that number of Ukrainian peasants, their hearts burning with an unquenchable feeling of malice. Oh yes, so much had been accumulating in their hearts. The lash of lieutenants' whips on their cheeks, the random shelling of recalcitrant villages, backs crisscrossed with stripes from ramrods wielded by Hetmanite Cossacks, and receipts written on torn pieces of paper by German majors and lieutenants. To a Russian sow for the purchase of one pig, 25 marks. All those appearing at army headquarters in the city bearing such receipts were greeted by loud, scornful laughter. And then there were the requisitioned horses, the pilfered bread, the fat-faced landowners returning to their estates under the hetman, and the spasm of hatred at the very mention of the word officers. Yes, sir, that's how it was. Then there were the rumours of land reform that the hetman was planning to carry out. But alas, it was only in November 1918, when the guns were already thundering on the outskirts of the city, that clever people such as Vasilisa realized that the peasants hated this hetman as if he were a rabid dog, considering such a dastardly plan to be totally unnecessary. Instead, what they needed was the age-old longed-for peasants' reform. All land to the peasants, 300 acres per man, the total abolition of landlords. The assignment of each 100 acres to be accompanied by a stamped official title deed attesting to the permanent entitlement of the land to be handed down from grandfather to father, father to son, son to grandson, and so on. No crook to come from the city to requisition grain. The grain belongs to us, and no one else can have it. What we can't eat, we'll bury in the ground. The city to keep us supplied with kerosene. But then, sir, no hetman, however respected, or anyone else for that matter, could ever have carried out reforms of that nature. There were some melancholy rumours flying around that only the Bolsheviks could deal with a disastrous situation such as the one created by the hetman and the Germans. But the Bolsheviks were no better. Nothing but a bunch of yids and commissars. The Ukrainian peasants are in a pretty miserable situation. Nowhere to look to for any salvation. Scores of thousands of people had returned from the front line, knowing how to shoot, having been taught how to do so on the orders of the high command. Buried in the ground and hidden in haylofts and barns were hundreds of thousands of rifles that had not been handed in, despite hastily set up German military field tribunals, whippings with ramrods, and shootings. Along with the rifles, millions of rounds of ammunition were buried. In every fifth village there were 3-inch guns and machine guns in every second, and each little town had its warehouses full of shells and its stores of greatcoats and fur caps. And in these same little towns there were school teachers, medical orderlies, smallholders, Ukrainian seminarists who by a twist of fate had become army subalterns, burly beekeepers' sons and staff captains with Ukrainian surnames, all speaking Ukrainian, all carrying in their heart the idea of a magical, imaginary Ukraine that was without landowners or those bloody Muscovite officers. In addition, there were thousands of Ukrainian prisoners of war who had returned from captivity in Galicia. Then, on top of this, the tens of thousands of peasants? Oh my God. Then there was this prisoner, the guitar, beset by rumours, terrible rumours. Hey, Nikolka. That's right. Twang away. The Turk, the rural hussar, Simon. Ah, but he didn't exist, did he? So it was all nonsense, legend, a mere mirage. And that notorious November, it was pointless for clever Vasilisa to clutch at his head and exclaim, Quos vult perdere dementat, and to curse the hetman for releasing Petliura from that foul city prison. It's all nonsense. If it's not him, then it'll be someone else. If not, then someone else again. And so all the signs ceased, to be replaced by the onset of real events. The second real event wasn't a trivial matter such as the release of some mythical person from prison. Oh no, this one was of such import that mankind will doubtless speak of it for 100 years to come. In far-off Western Europe, the Gallic cockerels in their red trousers pecked the thick-set, steel-clad Germans to within an inch of their lives. It was a terrible sight to see these cockerels in their Phrygian caps bearing down on the armour-plated Teutons with guttural screams and ripping out pieces of flesh and armour. The Germans fought back desperately, gritting their teeth and thrusting their broad bayonets into the feathered breasts of their opponents. But they were unable to hold out. And the Germans, begged for mercy. The next event was closely linked with this, and flowed from it as a direct consequence. The whole world, now stunned and shaken by what had happened, learnt that the man whose name and handlebar moustache, the size of 6-inch nails, were familiar to everyone, and whose body was probably fashioned entirely from metal, with no sign of any wood, had been deposed. Turned into dust, he ceased to be emperor. Then, when everyone in the city saw for themselves the colour fade from the German lieutenants, and the shining nap of their grey-blue uniforms become the colour of drab matting, a shiver of dread ran through them all like a whirlwind. And this happened there and then, in front of their very eyes, in the course of a few hours. And within just a few hours, the light in the lieutenant's monocled eyes faded, and then disappeared altogether, leaving nothing but a look of poverty-stricken despair. Then it was as if an electric current flowed through the minds of the brighter of those people who, with their solid yellowing suitcases and their plump wives, had leapt across the barbed wire of the Bolshevik encampment and made their way to the city. They realized that their fate was now linked with a vanquished nation, and their hearts were filled with horror.
"The Germans have been beaten," said the snakes.
"We have been beaten," said the clever snakes. The city's inhabitants realized this as well. Ah, yes, but only those who have been beaten know the real meaning of the word. It is like night-time in a house without electric light. It is like a room in which a green mold infested with harmful germs is creeping down the wallpaper. It is like demon children with rickets, or rancid cooking oil, or women using foul language in the dark. In short, it is like death. That's it, then. The Germans are leaving the Ukraine. What does this mean? It means that some will flee, whereas others will remain in the city, to come face to face with its new, uninvited and unpredictable guests. And it means that some will inevitably die. If those who flee the city don't die, who then will?
"Dying not child's prey."
It was the unmistakable voice of Colonel Nye Tours, confusing his R's and his L's as always. He had suddenly appeared from nowhere in Alexei Turbin's dream. Nye Tours was very strangely attired. He was wearing a coat of chainmail with a gleaming helmet on his head, and he was leaning on a sword, the sort of long sword that had not been part of the weaponry of any army since the Crusades. Behind him hovered an aura of heavenly, radiant light.
"Are you in paradise, Colonel?"
asked Turbin, a tremulous feeling of ecstasy coursing through his body, the sort of feeling experienced only in dreams.
"In paradise,"
Nye Tours answered in a pure, totally transparent voice, like a stream in an urban forest.
"That's very strange," said Turbin. "I always thought that paradise was simply a dream, and that's a very weird-looking uniform. May I ask, Colonel, whether you have retained your officer status in paradise?"
"The colonel's in the Brigade of Crusaders now, Doctor," observed Sergeant Major Zhilin,
someone who Turbin knew for certain had been killed in 1916 in the fighting around Vilna, together with his squadron of Belgrade hussars. The sergeant major towered up like a medieval hero, and his armor radiated light. His somewhat coarse features, which were extremely familiar to Dr. Turbin, as he had been personally responsible for bandaging Zhilin's lethal wound, were now unrecognizable. And the sergeant major's eyes were just like those belonging to Nye Tours, pure, bottomless, and shining with an inner light. Above all else, Alexei Turbin's melancholy heart loved female eyes. Oh yes, the Lord God had wrought a piece of magic when he had created a woman's eyes. But they were nothing like Sergeant Major Zhilin's eyes.
"And how about you?"
Turbin asked curiously, with a sense of unaccountable joy.
"You're in paradise, and yet you're wearing boots and spurs, so that means you've got horses, carts, pikes here."
"Believe me, Doctor,"
said Sergeant Major Zhilin in his deep, resonant bass voice, warming the heart with the expression in his light blue eyes as he looked directly at the doctor.
The whole squadron's there in cavalry formation, and we've got our accordion. It's all a little awkward, it's true. Everything's spotlessly clean, you know. Church floors.
Well, what happened? Asked Turbin, impressed.
Well, the Apostle St. Peter is waiting for us. He's an old man in civvies, but dignified and courteous. I report our arrival, of course. The second squadron of Belgrade Hussars has safely made it to Paradise, and so on and so forth. Where would you like us to be? There I am reporting our arrival, but all the time I'm thinking...
The Sergeant Major put his hand to his mouth and coughed modestly.
I'm wondering what he, St. Peter, is going to say. Perhaps he's going to tell us to go to the devil. You see, as you can probably understand, it's a question of what to do with the horses, and then...
The Sergeant Major scratched the back of his neck in embarrassment.
And then, between us, there's the women who waylaid us on the way. That's what I tell St. Peter, anyway. But I wink at the lads as if to say, we'll get rid of the women for the time being, and then we'll see. They can go and wait behind the clouds for a bit, and then we'll see how things work out. St. Peter may be his own master, but he's a positive sort of person. His eyes open wide, and I can see that he has spotted the women on the carts. Their shawls, of course, are clearly visible a mile off. Here's a pretty kettle of fish, I think. It's curtains for the whole squadron. Aha, he says, shaking his head. So you've got some women with you, have you? Yes, sir, I say. But please don't be concerned, Mr. Apostle, sir. We'll box them on the ears at once. No, you won't, he says. You keep your hands to yourselves. So, what are we to do now, eh? He's a kind-hearted old man, but as you can understand yourself, Doctor, a cavalry squadron can't go on the march without women.
And the Sergeant Major gave a sly wink.
That's very true, Alexei was forced to agree, looking down at the ground. For an instant, in the dark recesses of his dream, two dark eyes and birthmarks on a smooth cheek flashed across his mind. He grunted in embarrassment, and the Sergeant Major continued his story.
Right, sir, St. Peter says at once. I must report this. So off he goes. When he comes back, he says, all right, we can sort something out. And it's not possible to describe how happy that makes us. But then it turns out there's a little problem. The Apostle tells us we have to wait. But in fact, we don't have to wait for more than a minute. I look up, and who should I see?
And the Sergeant Major pointed at the silent and proud figure of Nye Tours, walking out of the dream into the mysterious darkness without leaving a trace.
I see the squadron commander trotting up on his horse, Thief of Toshino, and then a little behind him comes an unknown young cadet on foot.
At this point in his story, the Sergeant Major gave the doctor a sideways glance, then looked down at the ground for a moment. It was as if he wanted to hide something from the doctor, but it was clearly not anything sad. On the contrary, it was a wonderful secret that made him very happy. Then, recollecting himself, he went on with his story.
So, Peter looks at us, shielding his eyes with his hand, and says, right, that's everything. And immediately, the door is flung open, and he orders us to ride off by the right in threes. And suddenly, as if in a dream, the air is filled with the sound of metallic voices singing in chorus, accompanied by an Italian accordion. Oh, dunka, 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 dunya, my darling girl. Keep in step, shout the troop commanders in various different voices. Oh, dunya, 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 love me, dunya, love me, do. And a chorus of voices dies away in the distance.
So you managed to get in with the women, gasped Turbin. The Sergeant Major burst out in excited laughter and waved his arms about in joy.
Good God, Doctor, there's just so much space there, you know. And it's all so clean. At first glance, you might say you could accommodate 5 whole army corps there, together with their reserve squadrons. Then you realize it could take 10 corps, not 5. And then, gracious me, the church ceilings are so high there you can't see them. So I say, may I ask who all this is for? Because everything's so unusual. The stars and the clouds are red, something like the color of our shakos. All this, answers Apostle Peter, is for the Bolsheviks, those killed at Perekop.
What do you mean, killed at Perekop? Turbin asked, his mere earthly brain finding this all too difficult to grapple with.
This is because they know about these things in advance, Your Honour. In 1920, masses of Bolsheviks will be killed taking Perekop, so they have prepared accommodation to receive them.
Bolsheviks? Turbin exclaimed indignantly. You must be mistaken, Zhilin. That can't be right. They wouldn't be admitted there.
That's just what I thought, Doctor, sir. Just what I thought. So, confused, I asked God.
God?
Oh, Zhilin. You must believe me, Doctor, I'm speaking the truth. Why should I lie to you? I've spoken to God more than once.
What's he like?
Zhilin's eyes radiated light, and his face adopted an expression of pride.
For the life of me, I can't explain. His face is like aspen, but more than that, it's impossible to say. At times, you look at him and you grow cold. It seems that he is exactly like you or me. You're seized with such a feeling of terror that you wonder what's happening. And then, suddenly, it's all right. You're back to normal. His face varies, but there's such a sense of joy, of happiness. And then there's this blue light. No, it's not blue.
The Sergeant Major thought for a moment.
I don't know what it is. Anyway, it goes right through you 600 miles away. Well, anyway, I report to him and tell him that his priests say that all Bolsheviks will go to hell. I ask him why they say this. The Bolsheviks don't believe in you, I say, and you have cheered them up by promising such accommodation. So they don't believe in me, he asks. My true Lord God, I say, afraid you understand to be saying such things to God, but when I look at him, he's smiling. What a fool I am. Why am I bothering to tell him such things when he already knows everything better than I do? Yet I'm curious to find out what he'll say, and he says, well, if they don't believe in me, there's nothing you can do about it. Let them believe what they like. Either way, it leaves me indifferent, neither hot nor cold. That applies to you, as well as to them. I neither gain nor lose from your belief in me. Some people believe, others not, but everyone behaves the same. At the moment, you're all at each other's throats. As for the accommodation, Zhilin, you should understand that insofar as I am concerned, everyone killed on the field of battle is equal. You need to understand that, Zhilin. Not everyone does. But in general, Zhilin, don't concern yourself with such questions. Just live and enjoy yourself. A full explanation, eh, Doctor? But what about the priests, I ask? He makes a dismissive gesture. It would be better, Zhilin, he says, not to remind me about the priests. I won't spend sleepless nights wondering what to do with them. There's no more idiotic group of people on earth than these priests of yours. In confidence, Zhilin, they're a disgrace. Not priests at all. Well, Lord, I say, you should dismiss the lot of them. Why bother to feed such parasites? The fact is, Zhilin, I feel pity for them, he replies.
The aura of radiance around Zhilin turned blue, and the sleeping Alexei's heart was filled with inexpressible joy. Stretching out his arms towards the radiant Sergeant Major, he started groaning in his sleep.
Zhilin, oh Zhilin, could you not somehow organize it so that I can serve as a doctor in your brigade?
Zhilin waved his hand in greeting, and gently and firmly shook his head. Then he began to back away and move out of Alexei Vasilievich's dream. Alexei woke up, seeing in front of him not Zhilin, but the outline of the window growing gradually pale in the dawn light. The doctor wiped his face with his hand, feeling it moist with tears. He lay there in the dawn light for a long time, sighing. Soon, however, he was asleep again, and this time it was an uneventful, dreamless sleep. No, sir. Death was not slow in coming. As autumn turned to winter, it came along the Ukrainian roads, together with the dry, drifting snow. It began to show itself in the woods with the rattle of machine gun fire. Death itself remained invisible, but it was clearly preceded by an outburst of unbridled peasant fury, running howling and out of control through the blizzards and the cold, wearing torn bast shoes and with hay in its unkempt hair. In its hand, it carried a huge club, without which no enterprise in Russia is undertaken. The red roosters started to crow, and in the dying crimson sunset, the genitalia of Jewish innkeepers were hung up for all to see. And in Poland's beautiful capital, Warsaw, a vision of Henrik Sienkiewicz appeared, standing in the clouds with a spiteful smirk on his face. Then all hell simply broke loose, with bubbles expanding everywhere and leaping around in the air. The priests rang the bells under the green cupolas of endangered little churches, and revolutionary songs could be heard coming from nearby schools, their windows shattered by bullets. And along the roads came the ghost of old man Degtyarenko, reeking of homemade vodka and croaking terrifying words that formed on his dark lips, seeming to suggest something extraordinarily like a declaration of human and civil rights. And then this prophet Degtyarenko was lying on the ground, howling, while men with red ribbons on their chest were lashing out at him with ramrods. And even the subtlest mind could not cope with this paradox. If it's red ribbons, then ramrods are out of the question. But if it's ramrods, then red ribbons are impossible. Yes, you could definitely suffocate at such a time and in such a country. Never mind. Let it go to hell. It's all a myth, anyway. Petliura's nothing but a myth. He never existed at all. It was a myth every bit as remarkable as the myth concerning the non-existence of Napoleon, but far less pleasant. Then something else happened. That very same peasant fury had to be induced to travel along a certain road, for things are so magically organized on this earth that no matter how far fury travels, it always ends up by finding itself at the same fatal crossroads. It was all very simple. There would be chaos, but people would be found who would be able to deal with it. And then, from out of the blue, Colonel Toropets appeared. Toropets had apparently served with none other than the Austrian army. How is that possible? I assure you it's true. Then the writer Vinichenko appeared on the scene, famous for two things, for his novels and for the fact that it was only the magical wave of early 1918 that had thrust him to the surface of the seething Ukrainian ocean. Not wasting a second, the St. Petersburg satirical journals called him a traitor. Serves him right. Perhaps, I don't know. And then there's that mysterious prisoner released from the town jail. Back in September, nobody in the city could have imagined what three individuals possessing the talent to be in the right place at the right time could be hatching up, even in such an insignificant little place as Belaya Tsirkov. By October, however, people had a strong idea of what might be happening. Trains, their hundreds of windows blazing with light, began to leave the city's passenger railway station number one, taking the new but still broad-gauge railway line through newly established Poland and on to Germany. Telegrams flew everywhere. Away went diamonds, shifty eyes, slick partings, and money. People fled southwards, too, to the seaport of Odessa. And alas, by November, everybody had become very familiar with the name Petliura. It was everywhere, jumping out at you from every wall, from grey telegraph messages. In the mornings, it dripped down into the coffee from newspaper pages, and the divine tropical beverage immediately turned into the foulest stinking slops in one's mouth. It tripped around on everyone's tongue and was tapped out on keys by operators on Morse telegraph machines. The city became witness to strange and wonderful events connected with this strange, enigmatic word, which the Germans had taken to pronouncing as Petura. There were individual cases of German soldiers who had acquired the lamentable habit of roaming around the city's suburbs and disappearing at night. They disappeared at night, and during the day, it became clear that they had been murdered. As a result, the Germans started patrolling the streets in steel, basin-shaped helmets. They marched about, telling everyone to behave themselves in the glow of the street lamps. But no street lamp could disperse the chaotic mess that was inside people's heads. Wilhelm. Wilhelm. Yesterday, three German soldiers were murdered. Are you aware that the Germans are leaving, for heaven's sake? Trotsky arrested by workers in Moscow. Some sons of bitches have waylaid a train near Borodyanka and helped themselves to everything. Petliura has sent a mission to Paris. Wilhelm again. Black Senegalese troops in Odessa. The unknown mysterious name of Consul Enno. Odessa. Odessa. General Denikin. Wilhelm again. The Germans will leave, the French will come. It's the Bolsheviks who'll come, old chap! Keep your trap shut, old man.
The Germans have this contraption with a pointer. Place the contraption on the ground, and the pointer will tell you where a weapon is buried. That's something, isn't it? Petliura has sent a mission to the Bolsheviks. That's something else again, isn't it? Petliura, 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 Petura. Nobody, not a single person, knew what this Petura actually had in mind for the Ukraine, but absolutely everyone knew that he was a mysterious and faceless figure. Every so often, however, the newspapers published a photograph of a Catholic prelate they were sent, each one different, but each signed Simon Petliura. And people knew for sure that this mysterious and faceless figure wanted to conquer the Ukraine, and that in order to be able to do that, he would enter the city and take it.